You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
A couple of weeks ago, we talked about some of the sources for what we know about Jesus. We noted that Mark, the first canonical gospel, was written around the year 70 when the Romans sacked Jerusalem, making Mark a wartime gospel. After the fall of Jerusalem, Jewish refugees were scattered all over the Mediterranean. With some of them went the teachings of this Galilean peasant. And as the stories spread throughout the empire, Jesus' reputation came into direct competition with other religious figures, and before you know it, stories began to develop about Jesus' birth that would have sounded strangely familiar to pagans and Romans. In his book, Born Divine, The Births of Jesus and Other Sons of God, Robert Miller writes, "Whether Christian or pagan, ancient readers, before they even opened the biography of a hero, could expect to find a story about his divine begetting." By the 80s, various versions of Jesus' miraculous birth were widespread. And then along comes Matthew and Luke, who incorporate two of these versions into their gospels, stories that sounded similar to the births of pagan deities and were sure to enhance Jesus' credibility in the competitive world of first century godmen. Then along comes the Gospel of John, for whom not even a virgin birth is good enough. Oh no! John places Jesus' origin before creation itself. As our passage today will make clear, John associates Jesus cosmically with light itself. Now, this may seem like an odd metaphorical leap for us, but not when you remember that every winter solstice, the Romans would have been celebrating Saturnalia, or Sol Invictus, the festival of the unconquered sun, S-U-N. On the longest, darkest night of the year, pagans gathered to shout, "Hooray! It may seem like the darkness will triumph, but we know better. Starting in 3 days, the sun will begin its return to warm the earth and bring light to the world." So is it any wonder that the writer of John thought, "Perfect! Jesus is the light of the world." This kind of connection may have contributed years later, as Rome transitioned to Christianity, to Roman Christians then adopting Saturnalia as a celebration marking the birth of Jesus, a perfect occasion to celebrate the birthday of the one who was to bring light into the world.
Our words of wisdom are from the Gospel according to John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 5 and 10 through 14.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being.
What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. He was in the world, and the world came into being through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to what was his own, and his own people did not accept him.
But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, or of the will of man, but of God.
And the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory, the glory of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
A number of years ago, the kids here at the Fountains put on the Living the Questions Christmas pageant, Matt and Lucy's Virgin Births. It takes the traditional trappings of a standard children's Christmas pageant and reveals to performer and audience alike the two different birth narratives of Matthew and Luke. The play opens with Matt and Lucy volunteering to help with the pageant. The director asks them to run the rehearsal while she takes care of some last-minute details. Little do they know that the director will give them each a different script. As the shepherds wander on to sing their song, Matt is desperately fumbling through his script, unable to find any mention of them. "Hey, who are these guys?" Lucy calmly points out that they're right there on page 2 of her script. Then come the kings, and it's Lucy's turn to have a conniption. "There are no kings in my script." So the play goes on with conflicting storylines, characters, and settings. Matt and Lucy become increasingly frustrated until, as the play ends, the director explains how having two different stories gives us an appreciation of the diversity of ways early Christians expressed their understanding of who Jesus was. Unfortunately, most Christians have been allowed and encouraged by both Hallmark and conflict-avoidant churches to synthesize the two stories into one. It makes for a nice creche, but it doesn't reflect the faithfulness of those who put together the canon, who intentionally offered us two very different birth narratives to show how Jesus was interpreted by two different communities. Instead of two rich parables, we've chosen Cuisinart blended into mush. So let's look at a couple of other things that are safer to look at around Valentine's Day than around Christmas. For starters, the virgin birth. Now, I've talked about this many, many times before, I know, but the conventional story is so deeply ingrained in our culture, I think it's necessary to keep repeating so folks don't think they misheard me. It appears that Matthew's version of the virgin birth was a mistake. Maybe an honest mistake, but just as likely an intentional misrepresentation too. The author of Matthew found what he thought was a reference to Jesus' birth in the book of Isaiah. But here's the rub. Matthew was using a Greek translation of Isaiah, where the Greek translators had made an error in translating the Hebrew. They took the Hebrew word alma and translated it as the Greek equivalent of our English word virgin. The problem is, everywhere else in Hebrew scripture, alma means young woman, not virgin. Well, the young woman could be a virgin. True enough, but then why didn't they use the word for virgin, betula, which they do in over 50 other places. So, as Bill Nelson says, Isaiah appears to have referred to a young woman becoming pregnant, a rather ordinary event. This is where someone who's never heard this before inevitably says, "What? Jesus' birth ordinary? Mary's virginity questioned? Is this some liberal extremist plot to destroy Christianity?" Then I have to say, only if you think Paul and Mark are liberal extremists. St. Paul says that Jesus was born of a woman, just like us. Mark doesn't even bother mentioning Jesus' birth, evidently because there wasn't anything unusual to report. And who are our earliest witnesses, closest to the action? Paul and Mark. Matthew and Luke come along later, and as Dom Crossan says, gives Jesus an upgrade so that he can stand shoulder to shoulder with all the pagans who were also born of virgins. And yet, for many Christians, unquestioning belief in the historical fact of the virgin birth has become a litmus test of whether you're a true Christian or not. Some of you will say, well, there you go again, destroying people's faith. No. If believing in the literal historical virgin birth is important to your faith, then by all means, don't let me dissuade you. You are welcome to believe as you wish. But if it's that important to your faith, it may be worth going the extra mile to make sure you've got all the information, especially considering that this belief most people cling to is based on a scribal error. The bottom line is, who Jesus was and is not dependent on a miraculous birth story. At the heart of Christianity is a divinity we understand as incarnational. That's that shorthand word theologians use for a really complex idea. Jesus being the human expression of the divine. Incarnation. Incarnation, like chili con carne, right? With meat. Jesus is divinity with meat, with flesh. So you've got the earliest followers of Jesus all wanting to represent the incomprehensible mystery of the spirit of life being somehow uniquely present in this person, Jesus. But everyone understands it in a different way. In fact, each generation of writer pushes it further and further back in time. Paul believed this happened with the crucifixion and resurrection. Mark portrays God's Spirit coming upon Jesus at his baptism. Wait up, not good enough for Matthew and Luke. They trace Jesus' divinity to his conception and birth. And then, as we read today, John's Gospel suggests the Spirit of Christ being present since the dawn of creation. So, as we move along in time, as the tradition develops, each successive storyteller claims their own way of describing how divinity got into Jesus, each grasping at mystery, each expressing a unique vision of Jesus.
Jesus could not have been human if he had had the Holy Spirit for a father. That's a story that develops late. It comes out of the Mediterranean world. Virgin birth stories are a dime a dozen in the ancient Mediterranean world. That's the only way people in that era knew how to say, we've met something in this life that we don't think human life could ever have produced. Mm-hmm. There's not a biblical theologian of world rank anywhere, Catholic or Protestant, that still treats the birth stories of Matthew and Luke as if they're history. You know, stars do not wander through the sky so slowly that wise men can follow it. Fetuses in Elizabeth's womb don't leap to salute fetuses in Mary's womb to prove that Jesus was greater than John the Baptist. Shepherds don't wander into a crowded village of Bethlehem and find a baby with no more clues than he was wrapped in swaddling cloths and was lying in a manger. Those things are not history. But that doesn't mean that they aren't in touch with a powerful and profound truth, and that's the way we've got to go. So I think we've got to redo Christology. The virgin birth story is no longer taken literally. The cosmic ascension story is no longer taken literally. But the fact is that in the life of Jesus, we still believe that there was a literal experience of a living God. Now, maybe that forces you to rethink God. And if we can stop thinking of God as a great big parent figure up in the sky, a supernatural being who is external to life, and begin to think of God as the life power itself, the power of love itself, the ground of being, as Paul Tillich described it, which is always emerging in you, in me, and which emerged in Jesus of Nazareth in some remarkable kind of way.
Although the gospel writers tried to explain it with virgin births and councils tried to define it with formulas and creeds, we are finally left with what Jesus evidently had, the call to make the love of God real in the world. It's a nice sentiment, but what made it stick? What made it such a compelling message that people were willing to go out and risk their lives sharing it with others? Clearly, the spirit of life was present in Jesus in a way that made people stop in their tracks. Jesus' presence, his teachings, his message was transformational for people. And when you come right down to it, all the fuss about the virgin birth is just a distraction from Jesus' message. Clearly, many Christians would rather argue about doctrine than actually respond to the call to follow Jesus, to do what Jesus asked us to do. The message of the incarnation is that even though each of us is a clumsy mix of good and bad, assumptions, prejudices, missed opportunities, and good intentions, God can have God's way with us. If there is any truth to the Christmas affirmation, God is with us, Emmanuel, then the divine is involved in our affairs, gets dirty with us, and sometimes, just sometimes, can even affect beauty in and through us, because the Spirit is incarnate in us. Or as Athanasius, a 4th century theologian, put it, he became human so we might become divine. Once upon a time, there was an old shoemaker named Martin. He lived in a one-room basement apartment in a large city in Russia. All he ever saw through his one window looking out on the street was snow and feet walking by. Martin's wife was dead. His son died at 13. He was depressed. One day, a holy man came with a Bible he wanted rebound. That night, Martin fell asleep while reading the Gospels. "Martin," a voice called to him in a dream, "look in the street tomorrow. I will come visit you." He awoke the next morning convinced the voice had been that of Jesus. Martin faced the day with great anticipation. Stepping to the stoop to keep a sharp lookout, he noticed old Stephen, a retired soldier, shoveling snow, and invited him in for a cup of tea. The conversation was strained as Martin, distracted, kept looking out the window, waiting for Jesus. The morning passed. No Jesus. Martin notices a poorly dressed woman with a baby and invites her in. It's a bitterly cold day, and he offers her his wife's coat, a blanket for the baby, and some cabbage soup. All the while, Martin kept glancing out the window, expectantly waiting. Early afternoon, no Jesus. An old woman passes by, carrying a basket of apples and a sack of wood chips for her fire. Martin witnesses a boy snatch one of her apples. The woman grabs him and there's a scuffle. Martin runs out and convinces the woman to let him go. They strike a deal that if the boy carries the wood chips for her, she'll give him an apple. Martin felt good to have helped them settle their differences. And for a moment he'd forgotten what he'd been waiting for. Then he remembers. It's late afternoon, and still no Jesus. He puts his tools away, sweeps the floor, and sets the table for cabbage soup. Feeling foolish for having believed that Jesus would come, Martin lights a lamp and begins to read from the Bible. "Then the righteous will answer him, 'Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you a drink? When did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?' And the king will answer them, Truly I say to you, as you did it to one of these, the least of my brothers and sisters, you did it to me. Leo Tolstoy's story of Martin the Cobbler is entitled, Where Love Is, There Is God Also. What we do, for better or for worse, is the measure of the incarnation in the world. The incarnation is finally not just about Jesus alone, but about us. Wherever we find ourselves, the mystery of life dwells within us, not limited to a time or a place, but a part of every aspect of our lives. And wherever there is love, there is God also. As we strive to understand this idea of the incarnation for our lives today, the most important thing to remember is that the incarnation is not just about Jesus, not about something that happened 2,000 years ago. It's about us today. As Marcus Borg reminds us, the Christian life is about being in a relationship with a mystery that transforms us into more and more compassionate beings, into the likeness of Christ, every day. Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information, or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.